Hello and welcome to recording number 34 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. Today is July 14th, 2021. Steel Day. So we've just been reading through as Gord and Geller have arrived at the Woodman in the Adry Forest. What is it? Geller is speaking to the gathered people of this little town within the forest of free woods folk, and has described what might happen if Archibald of Nyron's forces are destroyed by the Great Kingdom, which, you know, kind of foretells what, you know, might have happened if there had been a Gygaxian Greyhawk Wars instead of, I believe it's Cook's Greyhawk Wars. All right, I'm going to start here on page 258, the final paragraph. As Geller paused briefly to let this sink in, some of those assembled voiced their concerns with shouts of, "How could all of this happen? And what would you have us do?" and similar remarks. When the speaker resumed, he did so by responding to the crowd. "How came this to pass is unimportant," Geller admonished, "for you and I can only speculate fruitlessly. What is happening is that even as we speak, the might of the great kingdom is moving toward the goal I have just told you of. One of its armies musters in distant Jalpa, and another in Primp. Neither is likely to move immediately, but they will be held, waiting victory in the north, and then Herzog Cheller's host will join that of Ivid to attack Almor. Closer to home, the Overking's own guards, with many other too, have left Edgefield and are within the northern expanse of this great forest." Here Geller was forced to pause a full minute while the audience vented its surprise and anger at this revelation. So here we have Geller stirring up the woodsfolk of the Adry Forest. Even on the Darlene map, we see Jalpa that is off of the Flamai River inside the Great Kingdom, and Primp on the coast there. Here they're first mentioned. Herzog Cheller, I forget who he is exactly. Is he the northern province leader? I'm not sure.
I don't think he's a northern province leader, but I'll check it.
Yeah, I could, you know, get over to the index and try to find out. And then we have mention of Edgefield. And there, if we, on Darlene's map, Edgefield looks to be just within the upper northeast of the Adry Forest, southwest of Nurl. So it's fairly, I don't know where they say, where this village actually is, more toward the center of the Adry. With the Darlene map, it is, I believe, 30 leagues across each hex, and that puts, that could put it fairly far away. And, if you look at the general position of things on the map, it doesn't really, on the Darlene map, it doesn't necessarily show exact locations, and things can be, very far from, like, the little center dots where a lot of things are located within a hex. It gives you a general idea and a lot of room for the individual DM to move things around. But so all these different places are all these different places that we're finding, they can be, they can be accurate and yet still, very much off the off kind of like off center from these hex locations on the Darling map from the folio in the 83 box set.
Cheller is his high and radiant grace, the Herzog of the South Province.
Well, the South Province, okay. And he is supposed to, you know, be ready to join the attack on Almar, which makes sense. He'd be coming up, attacking Almar from the south. All right. So, you know, we have these grand plans for these, you know, the grand plans for quite a battle that is shaping up here. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page number 259, which we were asked about yesterday about things occurring here, and we're coming right up to it. Paragraph 4. That horde is led by renegade woodsmen and forest bandits who will guide the army swiftly to Woodford. It appears that its objective is to storm Nurl from the west, thus placing itself as an axe across the artery of Archibald's line of communication and supply. Meanwhile, the supposedly beaten forces of North Province, commanded by the jackal Grenell, have marched from Eastfair. This troop purportedly is bolstered with many mercenary men-at-arms and is picking up contingents of humanoids as it goes, either at Flosh Crossing or Ongleford. The force will come across the Teaser Torrent, thus closing the jaws of the trap upon Archibald. All right, break right here. And this is part of the commentary that, you know, was made earlier today, that somebody wanted to know, that it seems like, I guess, you know, the current map that, you know, is done by Anna Meyer has Flosh Crossing and Ongleford of different spelling. I had noted that Sargent had, you know, very often done, you know, he seems to have read the book and, you know, the Saga of Old City and changed some names and perhaps even you know, locations. So on the map, we have Ongleford, which appears to be on the...
right on the Harp.
Yeah, on the branch of the Harp River.
Flash Crossing is in the bottom left.
Okay, yes.
Also on the Harp.
Yeah, and here we have reference that it is... the mention is not the Harp, but the Teaser Torrent.
Right, not in the Adry either.
And that Woodford is right in between the two on the Harp.
I think Woodford might be where Ongleford is. I mean, I don't know. I'm just guessing because it seems like it's more or less a straight travel along a pretty well-defined trail from Edgefield to what's on this map as Ongleford. But I think it might be Woodford. And then Ongleford and Flash Crossing would be up on the Teaser Torrent.
Yeah, is that to the right or left of this map right here, the teaser?
The teaser is north.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all out of the Adry. Nurl is bordered to the east by the teaser and then to the west by the Harp. So
they have
the Clinties and then Nurl, and either side is a river.
Yeah, there does seem to be, you know, quite a difference between how Gygax put it and how it was later related. Now, you know, I'm of the belief that, you know, if you have to choose between the two, I would definitely choose, you know, Gygax over the material that came, you know, after Gygax. And but you know, that a lot of people really they like the revisions done by Sargent, and a lot of people really came upon Greyhawk well after Gygax had left, and so for them, From the Ashes is much more relevant than, you know, the material out of these books, which they may not even have read or had easy access to. You know, and these are novels, and not setting, you know, setting books. It's just, they were definitely used to help create the From the Ashes setting version. And I just wonder why some of these changes, and I think some of it has to do with more like knowing the names, but not necessarily knowing the, you know, getting a little confused with the geography that is here.
Yeah, it's a tremendous amount of work. I mean, it'd be very easy to get confused like that.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, here we have this, and it is, you know, we're getting a lot of information here. And you know, campaign information, geographical information. So, and page 259 in these short paragraphs, we're getting quite a bit about, you know, mentions of various cities and towns and rivers and the plans that are going on and the various, you know, relations between, you know, the troops. So, you know, like here we're seeing something where the mention that, you know, the North Province leader, he is this Grenell, he is able to, he's got mercenary men-at-arms, and as he goes, he's sweeping up humanoids, and you just wonder now, how is he doing that? I would assume that in the North Province, they must already have relations with these friendly relations with these humanoids for him to be able to simply come by and not, you know, if he's got a decent sized army, not drive them off, but to recruit them. So that really speaks that the North Province leader, who, you know, Geller's calling a jackal here, is, you know, of an evil disposition. Even though it, you know, it seems to be in contention a little bit as, you know, maybe a breakaway from the Great Kingdom, and still able to support them and have a relation with, you know, like evil humanoids. All right. I'm going to restart here. It is page number 259, the third paragraph from the bottom. And what can a handful of fighters do about all that? Demanded a bearded fellow at the front of the ringing circle of woodsfolk. They are few, Stalker called back in reply. Folk are many, however. If we send runners, and Sperling here puts out our messages, and we thus gather ourselves, we too become an army. Break. Now, the Sperling, it was mentioned yesterday that there was a female magic user who Chert didn't seem to care for. And my from this context, I assume that she is Sperling, you know, named Sperling here. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 259, final paragraph. Why should we take arms against the stinking Iridians to rescue the swine of Nyrond? Came the rejoinder from the bearded man. It seems we benefit when such scoundrels as these fight each other. The dogs commanded by Ivid dare not come far within these leafy precincts to carry his writ. At this, Curly Greenleaf stepped forward. They do indeed dare entry into our forest, he said firmly. I know this, for my brothers and sisters of our order have brought me word of this boldness. And because of it, we druids have decided to take the side of Nyrond. The advancing army has been wicked. All woodsfolk captured have been put to the sword. The sacred groves have been laid low, the druid said, with clear hatred in his voice. The evil force moves swiftly and attempts secrecy, but they cannot hem in all of us. Some folk manage to avoid the swarming scouts who go before the horde, and druids have other means of foiling capture. What is dared now will be repeated again and again, unless these trespassers are given a lesson in manners, Curly concluded. Break. You know, it's very interesting that this is this is something that Caesar did. He even though Rome normally had a policy of allowing, you know, the local religions to go unmolested, at least the prominent ones, what Caesar did when he was in Gaul is he destroyed all the Druids and Druid groves and shrines and everything that he came across. So, you know, this reminds me of that action. Even though, you know, I don't really see the Great Kingdom and North Province as such as kind of a parallel to, you know, a parallel to Rome. I've kind of see the old Sul Imperium as that. But here we've got, you know, something, that action of destroying the Druid groves. And it seems kind of strange that they would rile up the Druids just at the time when they're hoping to destroy, you know, Archibald's Nirondel army. And, you know, there was a question is that there's a Battle of Woodford and that is mentioned and where it takes place. And as it's mentioned in the book, it seems like it's either going to be the Flosh Crossing or Ongleford. And that's where the Jaws of the Trap against Archibald, or Archibald, of the King of Nirond, are supposed to close on him, and when the force crosses the Teaser Torrent.
Yeah, if things go the Great Kingdom's way, Archibald is in big trouble, because he's going to have, let me see, he's going to have the Jackal, I guess.
Grendel, yeah.
From the east. I think he's going to have the Herzog coming from the west, and he's going to have the humanoids in the Bone March coming down from the north. So he's going to be in trouble.
Yes, you know, because if it has his own force, I'm not sure if the Herzog, I thought he was the south province.
Oh, right, he's waiting. Yeah, that's right. He's probably going to go to Almar.
Yeah. I assume after they destroy Archibald, they're going to crush Almar. It, you know, which is kind of signaling to you know, Cook, who wrote the Greyhawk Wars, at some of the events there, but done in a very harsh fashion that really, you know, changed the campaign. Whereas Gygax at this point wasn't looking for such, you know, total warfare that, you know. Normally, you know, like things would go back and forth, and there wouldn't be such annihilation like they had in the Greyhawk Wars and utterly destroying Chathold. Normal war from, you know, the late medieval and Renaissance did not have normally such, you know, such utter annihilation. You know, there were a couple places that were known for, you know, the terrible sacking, like Magdeburg, and that, but they stood out because that was not, you know, exactly the common thing that happened. And I really think that Gygax was looking more toward a kind of warfare that was fought in Europe in, you know, in the late medieval and the Renaissance period, you know, like.
I really think Woodford is in the position of Angleford on the map, mainly because of the name, right? Normally, wood and ford would be a ford in the wood.
Yeah.
So it would be in the wood. I'm just guessing, though.
Yeah. I, you know, I can see now we have crossing and two fords.
Mm-hmm.
So it does sound like they both, all three, Angleford or Ongleford, Flosh Crossing, and Woodford, would all be on the river and all be either fords or ferries. Like Flosh Crossing might be a ford, or it may be a ferry boat, because there is a city or a town on the other side on this map. I don't know if it occurs you know, in Gygax's campaign.
I don't see any of them on Darlene's map.
Yeah, and there's a town, or a village, or a thorpe, called Druid's Well, and that may be where, you know, what we're talking about here, this meeting, is taking place, but that, again, is nothing mentioned so far in this story.
Yeah, we'll have to keep our eye out the pages ahead to see if we can find a more definitive location for Woodford.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to restart here. It is page 260, paragraph 2. The evil force moves swiftly and attempts secrecy, but they cannot hem in all of us. Some folk manage to avoid the swarming scouts who go before the horde, and druids have other means of foiling capture. What is dared now will be repeated again and again, unless these trespassers are given a lesson in manners, Curly concluded. Those remarks were greeted by general agreement, and some cheering from the gathering. The brief debate ended, and the topic became how best to put a plan into action. Eventually, the woods folk agreed that a handful of the swiftest runners would carry word to the surrounding areas, and the forces of the area would meet at Oddgrave Hill, the place that Curly Greenleaf said was serving as the focal point for all of the woods folk willing to bear arms against the marauding army. Then the assembled folk quickly dispersed, each going off to ready his affairs for whatever part each chose in the coming days. Gellar pulled Gord aside and inquired what the young man planned to do. Gord said he had not thought much about it, but it was likely that he'd join with the woodsmen if they had no objection. A fight such as this promised to be something he had never experienced, and who could tell what would come out of it? His friend nodded in pleasure at Gord's decision, wished him well, and told Gord that he hoped to see him again when the bands gathered at Oddgrave Hill for the march to Woodford. Gellar would be briefly occupied by certain things that needed his personal attention, but he said that he would be at the great gathering place before the war bands marched. Break. All right, so we have Oddgrave Hill. I don't see, you know, on this map any place. Maybe a wider perspective shows Oddgrave Hill, but they're supposed to march toward Woodsford.
Yeah, I've looked. I haven't seen the hill.
Oddgrave, yeah, Oddgrave Hill. So we know that wherever this thorpe is, that Druid's Well, one of the problems I see on the map is Druid's Well is on a well-trodden path.
Yeah, that's probably not it then.
Yeah, because this is not it is, you know, if you figure 40 dwellings, that's probably bigger than Hamlet. But at the same time, it's said that you can't see it from, you know, a distance because it's hidden in the woods. And Druid's Well is actually, you know, that is a fairly, to the north of Druid's Well, leading to Woodsford is a much smaller, pathway. So it really does make me think that this could not be Druid's Well. And it should be big enough to be noted on a map. And of course, you know, here I am saying things and, the Adri Forest, according to Darlene's map, is just a big empty, it's just a big forest space. Mm-hmm. And we don't see that the type of detail, Anna Meyer put into this, you know, much, much smaller scale map because, one of her hexes is just about a third the size of one of the big Darlene hexes. So we're really looking at, you know, quite, a more defined scale here. And we're going to see a lot more detail that's been added. And also this is Gygax era, which was it was a different campaign than, you know, what came out of second edition and the post-Gygax era. So you know, there is, you know, I always felt that they should match, and I always take my cue more from Gygax than from Sargent, or you know, Moore, or you know, Cook, or you know, Sean Reynolds. I never really followed their work as much, so you know, there could be, you know, a meritous disagreement here. I don't know how much, you know, as we're reading this, I don't know how much we can gain from Sargent in later talk, you know, later setting material about these particular areas. This is the focus here in the story. I don't know offhand how much of the focus it is in the setting material.
They haven't mentioned crossing the harp yet, right?
I don't.
At least not after they left Inspa.
Yeah, you
they
know.
Might have. I forget how they got here from Nurl, but I don't think they mentioned
from
Nurl.
All right, Nurl. They go west and they go to the Gnome King, and okay. Then they decide from the news that Geller has gotten of trouble in the Adri. Instead of going to Ralmord, they go and go to Inspa. And then from Inspa, they travel through the foothills, the forested foothills at the end of the Flinties for 3 days. Then they come upon this little town. Okay. There's no mention of, I think, a river crossing.
Right.
But, you know, there's a lot of... you know, travel.
I'm sorry. When they left Nurl, did they go back to that ferry spot? Is that what they said?
Yes, I believe they.
So then they crossed
yes.
the harp. Then they crossed the harp there.
They crossed the to the west.
Yeah, that's where the harp is.
Yeah, so they crossed the harp near Castle Blumu and Nurl, because I think it was just one day that took them across that.
When they went to see the Gnome King.
Yes, and they stayed at some little village before they got there.
Okay.
So, you know, where they, Geller and Geller, they and Gord stopped for the night after using
that story. Right. And he said that he was glad that he didn't take the other path. I remember that now.
Yeah. And then the Gnome King, someplace in the Flinty Hills, and then down to Inspa, and then east to where they are right now.
Okay.
And still, you know, like we're hearing of these various geographic locations, but there's really no, you know, no description of them that we're running across in the story about. We don't even know the name of this small village or, you know, hamlet or thorp here that... you know, where they're at right now with the woods folk. We have gotten a new name of this Oddsgrave Hill that doesn't seem to have made it over to, you know, over to this map. You know, we just have a Yellow Wretch and Druid's Well. You know, it could be various places. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 260, final paragraph. It required the rest of that day and all of the next for the members of Stalker's community to prepare for their journey and to wait for the return of the messengers who had gone out. Gord busied himself by procuring a piece of tough but supple leather and using his dagger to cut and shape it into a sling, which he thought would be handy in the days to come. Then he searched out a good pouchful of properly sized stones, practiced for a while, and felt satisfied that his sling would be a good addition to the woodsfolk's large and varied collection of missile weapons. Break. You know, I was talking and commenting about skill systems, and I, you know, I've mentioned how Gord, that Gygax really does a good job of describing you know, either background skills or, you know, what they did in second edition with, like, skill points and gaining practical skills. You know, he learned to ride with the Atloy, and he learned to boat with the Rene. And he talks, and he ran, also learned how to do acrobatics. And he talked, especially mentioning the riding, about how he practiced and practiced. And so if you're developing a character as a player, it is good to start this business with noting down, you know, background information and where certain skills are learned. So right here we have Gord crafting a sling, which I would say probably doesn't require, you know, a tremendous amount of skill, but using a sling, that does. I mean, even with Gord's natural abilities, for him to, if he hasn't had practice in using a sling, which is normally a very long, you know, a pouch, small pouch to hold the stone or the bullet, and a very long, you know, leather contraption so you can really wind up a very powerful shot with the sling. The accuracy of it is going to be, unless you've had practice and training in it. Now, with Gord, I'm not sure if it ever mentioned before. I don't really think. Oh, it, no, did. It did.
Yeah, remember when he was running from the emissaries of the,
guy from the pale?
Right, and he mentioned that he could use a sling and probably hit and kill one of them, but the time that it would take to do that, he would get one and then they'd be on him. So he could mention
that's,
it.
That's great. So, I mean, we don't get a thing about when he first learned it, but in the story, it already preps this point where part of Gord's background then is that he knows how to use a sling.
Yeah, at least the basics.
Yeah, and I have made, you know, very simple slings myself. My accuracy was terrible, but actually crafting a, you know, a sling is not tremendously difficult. So I wouldn't say that, that you need, I think you'd have to have some idea about slinging, and if he has already gained the experience of using one, which this implies, then, you know, he definitely has some kind of training in it. Now, that itself might not be a skill as much as a weapon proficiency in the game, because it's not something very simple. Weapons training in the game, you know, really is separated from, you know, non-weapon skills and background. So, you know, you wouldn't, and I, you know, I don't really have a big problem with that, but you wouldn't be using, say, you know, the talk of, you know, learning, you know, knowing which weapons and knowing armor in just in the basic backgrounds. That would be up in the forefront because it's such a critical bit of knowledge. I mean, it seems like it's critical to know how to ride, but you can see with Gord from the city, he wouldn't necessarily, you know, know riding skills. You know, he lived his life within the walls of that city.
In the first part of it in the slums, so.
Yeah. So, you know, he really did have to learn at some point how to ride and use a boat. But those are really secondary to what kind of weapons he can use. You know, so I would assume that this is just one of his choices. In gaming speak, but otherwise it's one of the things that they trained him probably in the Beggars Union.
Well, it's good to see he's actually training with this specific sling, because I imagine just like different swords are different slings would be different. So he just fashioned this one, and he's getting a little practice to see if it has any inconsistencies or differences or similarities or whatever, so they're making sure he can hit things with the one that he has now.
Yes, and with weapon proficiencies, I feel as a DM that your players should mention, you know, that they're keeping their skills up, because you know, if you're a pianist and you don't practice the piano, you lose your skills.
Right.
I tutored math, and if you did not keep up, you know, using your what skills you learned in math. It did. There was a lot of things that you had to remember, and if you use them every day, then you just knew them. But over a period of time, unless you had, you know, a superior memory, which I do not, it just was something that would fade on me. So like that, I would say that if, you know, and here's a question, is a sling hard to use? I can only speak for myself and say that I was dreadfully inaccurate with it, no matter how much training I used. But, you know, that's just my coordination, probably low dexterity there. And a sling is much different from a slingshot. A sling allows, I don't know, is it 2-3 feet of length? And you really wind up that thing. So it, you know, builds up a lot of power when you release it, enough to, you know, really kill somebody with it. Yeah, you know, it's like nunchucks. It's one of those things where swinging that around, you can whack yourself in the face with it, but you can
also... Especially the between the leg shot.
Yeah, and it is also terrible about whacking into somebody nearby, you know, because it is a couple feet of length that you're winding up. So, that was one of the things about bow over sling, was that bow, you can have much tighter formations than you can have with slingers.
Siggy has given us a disclaimer.
Don't do this at home. And that is true. It is true. A sling's easy to make, but I found it, if you're not a dexterous person, it can be dangerous to use. All right. And, you know, of course, he's got the big advantage of making one with that, you know, insta-cut long-tooth dagger there that's going to go right through the leather. All right, I'm going to restart. We're on page 261, paragraph 2. Counting a scattering of fighters who came from isolated dwellings nearby, the group that had assembled by nightfall of the second day numbered 20, about a third of whom were women. Most carried longbows and short, broad-bladed spears, in addition to axes of all sorts, and a very few carried swords at their belts. Most of the women were clad in leathern coats and carried bows only slightly smaller than those of the men. These latter folk were more heavily protected, generally wearing shirts of scale or chainmail under the rough brown and green clothing. Chert had given his new companion a cloak of olive hue to wear over his black garments, and it was such a great expanse of cloth that Gord had to slice off a broad strip from its hem so that it would not drag on the ground behind him like some cleric's long ceremonial train. A friendly neighbor gladly plied her needle to make a new hem, and the cut-off strip became a tabard to cover the polished black cuirass of hard leather Gord wore. Save for his black boots and his lack of a bow, he might have been one of the lads from the forest, bent on joining the impending fray. Break. Well, you know, it's good to see that he has the women taking an active role, and that's very much common to, say, like, you know, the Norse Vikings, where quite a number of the people going out Viking were women. The Eastern tribesmen, like the Magyars, they, you know, their women too participated and knew how to fight and fire a bow, you know, mostly in a defensive capacity, but, you know, also raiders out with the men and the horse nomads. So, you know, it's good to see that in, you know, this book where Gygax does seem to be, you know, the women are not usually playing you know, a combat role, that here the wild free people of the forest here, they're one third of that group. Now, you know, it's a small group at about 40 fighters, but imagine if this is a group where you have various levels, like Curly Greenleaf is a 10th level druid. He is in first edition AD&D, he is four levels away from, you know, the Grand Druid. And it didn't go higher than 14th in the game. And Gord is up there. Geller's definitely up there. And Gord is certainly up there. Now, if, say, these people who are going to war as these, you know, these ranger or woods fighters in the game system, one individual who's higher level is more than a match for, you know, a large number of low-level monsters, humanoids, low-level bandits who may be zero or first level and are unlikely, unless they're leaders, to be higher than second level. So if you have 40, say, mid-level fighters and a, you know, spattering, and we already do have a handful of various high-level characters, they are, you know, they're going to go through the lesser fighters. And, you know, it's something to keep in mind that that is, you know, Gygax is trying to make this story, you know, more believable. But at the same time, he's using the AD&D rules. So that's the physics of the game. And so if this batch of fighters, of 40 or so individuals like this, come up against several times their, you know, hundreds of lower level fighters, they're going to be killing them left and right. And, you know, because a couple of arrows are enough to kill a zero or first level fighter or a low level humanoid. Whereas most of these fighters are going to be, you know, they're going to be able to avoid, rather than say that they're able to take a more physical damage. Hit points in the game don't necessarily mean that you can be stuffed full of arrows. Instead, they mean that it's more likely that the arrows, you know, will be avoided, and there's kind of this buildup. And it is in the simulation, there's a lot of, you know, people who want to equate every hit with physical damage. And yet, this is combat in AD&D is not that direct a simulation. And so, like a near miss, you know, that might remove some of your luck or your skill at avoiding. Maybe it tires you a little. So there's a lot of things in the simulated combat that those hit points reflect, because they reflect experience gain. And experience gain can be simply that you're better at, you know, avoiding blows, and, you know, you've got this developing skill, rather than suddenly, you know, you have the body capacity of an ox or a dinosaur, that, you know, you may have monsters that have a lot of hit points and can take a lot of physical damage. But normally when you have a human or a demi-human who starts off at a low level and gains experience, that is not, you know, represented by actual physical damage. It's represented by, you know, simulating combat and being able to turn or turn blows and attacks on you. Kind of like in the, I'm trying to think of that movie with Carradine, the television show, Kung Fu, mm-hmm. where he could, you know, knock arrows out of the air with his bare hands. But, you know, those could actually, every time, that's actually a monk's skill in the game, but it could be seen also that those might even be physical hits, where he has this ability to, you know, have arrows or spears or things. If they come too close, it may exhaust him a little. It may take away some of his chi or his luck. And, you know, so we could see hit points reduced, but not actually drawing blood. So, then we have this business of, you know, how the women seem to have scale or chainmail. Gord is actually given a camouflage cloak, just green, cover the black. Although black is not a terrible, you know, it's not a terrible disguise. It doesn't stand out, you know, like colors more toward the red scale. Like, you know, the red and orange and yellow, you know, a fierce yellow within a green forest, they can stand out because of the contrast between, you know, the colors. But black, black itself can fade into, you know, the background, especially if the colors are mottled rather than solid. Like even a solid green cloak can have too much of the physical form showing off against the brown and varicolored bushes. So that's why, you know, it would be good to have a camouflage cloak that had, you know, not just browns and solid browns, solid greens, but instead broke up the human shape from the eye and, you know, allowed people to, you know, kind of meld with the varied mottled look of a forest. All right. I'm going to restart right here. It is page number 261 and the second paragraph from the end. Next morning, as soon as it was light enough to see, the war band led by Stalker went forth, following forest path and game trail in a northeasterly direction, heading for the rendezvous at Oddgrave Hill. Curly Greenleaf was with the company, and rather than take a position of status at the head of the column, he strode merrily along with Gordon Chert near the rear, telling stories, uttering bad jokes and worse puns, and generally making the march seem shorter and easier by his presence. Gord asked Curly numerous questions about druids and the druidical belief, and the bald fellow was only too pleased to reply at length to such inquiries. Chert grumbled that he cared nothing about such stuff, but he listened all the same, and occasionally chimed in himself on one point or another. They covered some 30 miles thus, and picked up another 10 fighters along the route, so when evening camp was made, the war band numbered over 50. Break. You know, that is quite a pace through a thick forest. You know, all these people have wood skills. So I'm not sure if they're all supposed to be druids or rangers or barbarians, or if they are kind of a woods folk fighter that just happens to have some skills similar to what would normally be attributed to a barbarian or a ranger. But definitely they're traveling 30 miles in their single day's travel in thick woods. That is you know, pretty good achievement. You know, normally soldiers travel, I believe, around 20 miles, you know, in column as a group. And although this isn't a big group, it's still now 50 people traveling together. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 262. Paragraph 2. Stalker spoke to the warriors that night, giving them advice on how the enemy was likely to react and fight. The arrows of the woodfolk must be made to tell, for at close quarters the well-armored Iridians were certainly likely to give far better than they got. The warband leader then divided his company into 5 sub-bands. Each of these squads had its own leader, who would take instructions from Stalker and see that the fighters in his or her group did precisely what they were told. Both Gord and Chert were assigned to a woman called Wren, who was nothing like her name, being nearly as tall as Chert and hefting a bardich heavier than the brawny barbarian's own great axe. As the two young men were eating their portions of the half-raw, greasy meat provided by a hungry bear that had ventured close to the humans, thinking to find its own dinner, their newly assigned commander came over and joined them. Wren gnawed on a piece of meat, eyed them critically, and addressed Chert first. "You I know about, big boy," she said disdainfully, but in a jesting tone. Stay back and don't go rushing out until I give you a whistle. Now what about Shorty here? He hasn't got a bow, and he's too small to go hand in hand with those beefy soldiers the Overking favors. Can he tend wounded? This irritated the young thief, so he snapped off a response before the barbarian could swallow the hunk of tough meat he was chewing on and reply to the query, which was actually directed at Chert. Break. All right. We have here, barbarians are tough and hardy fighters, hardened by the savage lands of their birth. They have 12-sided hit dice and a base movement rate of 15 feet. They can run at full speed at twice for no less than 3 full days before having to rest by spending a day moving at normal rate. Similarly, endurance will be twice normal for movement situations. And here's from the rules about barbarians. Now here, Ren is being called a barbarian. And the way that the Gygax has this story, I believe that this is more than just the way that, you know, barbarians were called as a denigration. I believe this is actually a mention of what is a specific kind of character class. So there's lots of times when Gord is referring to men-at-arms and various things that actually have a different meaning in the game than they would to just as a descriptive name for a profession. So that they have certain abilities in the game, just the way the barbarians are shown here, to have certain set abilities. So I'm assuming that Ren and probably a good proportion of these woods folk are actually barbarians, but they're woods barbarians.
Yeah, they can move very quickly.
Yeah, and it is, you know, this is being shown, and it's one of the things I really like about the Gord novels, is he shows you how the various, you know, dry abilities described in the rules actually look in a situation that it's not written just to be dramatic. It is written to take the various abilities, like Gord's various thief skills and such, and show them in a live, you know, lively narrative, how they would look and how they can be described. So here, when Gord mentions that they traveled 30 miles in that one run through the full, the heavily wooded Adri, it's encapsulating this ability that barbarians have. It's showing game mechanics being brought to life.
In fairness, that is one of the barbarians' tertiary abilities, so not all of them would have it, but I would think a number of them would.
Yes, and not perhaps quite the running skill, but definitely some kind of swift movement through dense wood.
Right.
I haven't read up on the barbarian rules, but it's this really
it's an unearthed arcana thing.
Yeah, and this really is the people being described. I know Chert is described as a barbarian. Ren's being said to be a barbarian, but they're kind of different from, say, the northern barbarians who exist in, you know, a cold realm. Here, these are like woods barbarians. So a lot of the things seem very ranger-like to me, you know, a lot of these abilities.
Yeah, I believe the book says you can have all kinds of different barbarians. Just like the biome or where they live would determine their skill set.
Yeah, see, that's very good. All right, we're just about 5 minutes left, but I am going to do a little more reading here. We're on page 262 and the third paragraph from the end. This irritated the young thief, so he snapped off a response before the barbarian could swallow the hunk of tough meat he was chewing on and reply to the query, which was actually directed at Chert. "The name is Gord," he said angrily. "I answer all questions about myself, and I fight well enough for any to fear, beefy soldier and beefy woodsman alike." As soon as he had said the last statement, Gord regretted his words. What he had said was insulting and unfair, and it was foolish to pick a quarrel with one swordmate. Besides, while she was large indeed, the proportions displayed by Wren were by no means beefy. Voluptuous, yes, but not beefy. The woman took no offense. In fact, her reaction was quite the opposite of what Gord had expected to hear. "Gord it is," she said, buffeting him on the back in comradely fashion. "If you fight as tough as you talk, then I'll be glad to have you by my side." Gord drew forth his sling, displaying the thonged leather pouch to both Wren and Chert. "This bit of hide can send stoning kisses to the enemies, just as your bows send their shafts," he said, "although I admit that amidst these trunks it is a more difficult task. I also ply short sword and dagger with sufficient skill to have brought ruin to one or two foemen. Trust me to fight alongside my fellows, as long as there is cause to do so." Wren sat with them and proceeded to finish her meal in their company. The three talked, and it soon became obvious to Gord that their purpose was to seek out Chert, not to speak of the coming battle or give instructions. The muscular giant was friendly and talkative in return, but he made no response to the overtures Wren offered, and when she said she thought a walk in the forest would help her to loosen tired muscles and cause sounder sleep, Chert cheerfully wished the brown-haired and buxom warrior an enjoyable stroll and a good slumber. Her hazel eyes snapping, Wren left with a curt nod, her long braids bouncing. "Are you blind, man?" Gord hissed at his companions. "That woman is terrific, and she was almost begging you to go off into the woods for some loving." Chert shrugged, and Gord grew suddenly suspicious. Or not, he let the thought trail off, reluctant to finish it, and sorry that he'd brought up the subject. "Oh," Chert asserted hotly, fully aware of what Gord had been getting at. "It's just that I only like women with golden tresses and eyes of azure. Sometime I'll tell you about a dark-haired wench who nearly sundered my heart. But not now. The time has come to hush talk of females and get some shut-eye." Break. Now, here's a picture of I can't remember the
Sandel actress. Bergman.
Sandel Bergman from the Conan movies, which seems to be Chert's ideal mate there, and the kind of woman he's looking for. And, you know, rightly so there. But, and again, Gord has his, you know, typical reaction to female characters he runs across. All right. It is 7 o'clock. And I wanted to get to the end of the chapter, but we're still a page or two away. So I'm going to end it here for the night and call up Craig, our recording bot. And let me just get this here. And end this for tonight. It is July 14th, 2021. And this we're stopping at on page 263. That puts us at 89 pages to go. All right. Let's see. I'm going to call up Craig, and it's been great being here tonight.
Good night.